Snatter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nimmer Snatter, just this talking to teachers.
This week on Nimmer Snatter, I am delighted to be joined by Dame Alison Peacock, the Chief Executive of the Chartered College of Teaching. Professor Dame Alison Peacock was appointed in August 2016 and became the Chartered College's Chief Executive in January 2017. Prior to joining the Chartered College, she was Executive Head Teacher of the Wroxham School in Hertfordshire, and her career to date has spanned primary, secondary and advisory roles. She's a member of the Royal Society Education Committee, a peer member of the Teaching Schools Council, and a trustee of both Chartered Institute of Educational Assessors and of Teach First. And in March 2015, Alison was appointed by the DfE as a member of the Commission on Assessment Without Levels, and she's the author of Assessment for Learning Without Limits. And in this in-depth and wide-ranging interview, we discuss Alison's career in primary and secondary education, her work at the Wroxham School in the early 2000s and the journey she took the school on. We also talk about Learning Without Limits and the ethos behind Learning Without Limits and the effect it had locally and nationally. We also talk heavily about educational research and evidence, and Dame Alison Peacock has been at the forefront of that long before it became the latest thing to do. Alison was involved in education research and evidence, and that's formulated a lot of decisions she's made in her career. We also talk about her book from 2016, Assessment for Learning Without Limits, and how that was based on two research studies. And she advocated what was quite a different alternative pedagogy at the time, moving away from levels, and we go in depth about that. We also talk about her work as the Chief Executive of the Chartered College. We talk about the values and the vision and the mission of the Chartered College. We also talk about the huge impact that the Chartered College has had already on what I've called re-professionalising teachers, and I ask Dame Alison Peacock how she's gone about this. We also talk in detail about Impact Magazine and how I think it's an absolutely fantastic read, and now without plastic as well, so you can feel that you're helping the environment whilst you are reading research and evidence articles. We also ask her how she goes about selecting those articles, and we talk about, for anyone who is not a member, how can you get involved and where can listeners get in touch. So it's a fantastic episode. But before we get into that, we're going to head over to the studio where we have Michelle and David waiting for us with bespoke input from the Teacher Development Trust related to this week's guest, Dame Alison Peacock.
As today's
over to
main
you,
guest
Michelle.
Is Dame Alison Peacock, we thought it might be useful to think about the whole idea of collegiality. David, what does the research say?
So thanks, Michelle. Thanks, Phil. There's some really interesting research from Learning Policy International from Kinney and Podolsky. This was a report in 2016 that was looking at what are the factors that allow schools to keep more experienced staff. And Kinney and Podolsky come up with these two very important sentences. The first one is that schools with lower attrition rates and often more experienced teachers tend to have a collegial culture, which they say is rooted in teachers' shared knowledge and practice. So that collegial culture, which of course, in this case, is great because we're talking about a college of teaching. So in contrast, they say schools with higher attrition rates and often fewer experienced teachers tend to have a disjointed knowledge base within the school and a lack of coherence of teaching practice. And that really talks about this idea of collegiality as this sort of shared professionalism, this real sense that people have a shared understanding of things.
I guess that's easy to say, but hard to do. What are some of the concrete things that schools can do to increase collegiality?
So how do we create this sort of professional collegiality? Yeah. So I think the first thing, we often talk to schools about repurposing meeting times. So, for example, in a secondary school, it might be meeting with a subject team. In a primary school, it might be meeting with a phase team, or potentially in a curriculum or subject team as well. And how can you make those times more around talking about curriculum, about pedagogy, about assessment, and less about administrative tasks, briefing tasks? If you've seen this pupil, tell her she's lost her scarf, that sort of thing. So repurposing that time allows more conversation, more professional dialogue around how we do things here, what our shared vision is, and how that contributes together, how those two pieces fit together to create this shared sense of what works. So that's the first thing. The second thing would be, in order to give people this real deep root into their professional practice, then we want to try and timetable for stability. So ideally, particularly in the early career of a teacher, you want to try and ensure that next year, that teacher will have many of the same topics they taught this year. Ideally, similar age of children, ideally, similar sort of type of children, potentially. You don't want to hold everything the same. But if, for example, this year I'm teaching Year 7 Maths, and next year I'm teaching Year 7 Maths, and the year after I'm teaching Year 7 Maths, I will clearly accumulate not only general teaching skills, but also that real sense of my subject, what it means, how that works. And as a result of that, I'll have better conversations with my colleagues. I'll gain expertise. They'll be able to work with me. I'll be able to create shared resources. I can pass that on to others. And it's much harder to do that if you don't feel rooted in a topic and everything is always new. So I think that stability is very important. And then as a result of those two things, I've alluded to the sharing of resources and the sharing of language. That's really important that if I am planning a lesson, I can draw on our shared collegial wisdom, not just, oh my goodness, rush onto a well-known website and download resources at the last minute, but how can I use the resources which my colleagues have created? Maybe we've had conversations around, maybe we've studied together, maybe I've contributed to. So shared resources leads to a shared language. The more that you and I have professional dialogue about what we're doing, the more we'll start using the same language. And that doesn't need to be something that's sort of laminated and put on every staff room wall to say, we will all use this language, because that doesn't work. As Mary Meyer says, you've got to live it, not laminate it. So using these terms, repeating them, having lots of dialogue, that creates that collegiality.
Thanks, David. I have to say, whenever we audit a school's approach to CPD, you really get a strong sense of how collegiate the staff are. While many places we visit do feel like families, fewer reach that next level of being professionally collegiate. Not just great social connection, but real shared professional connection as well.
Yeah, I agree.
You can find out more about this topic and ways to improve collegiality by visiting tdtrust.org. Back to you in the studio, Phil.
Podcast Pedagogy. Podcast Pedagogy. Podcast Pedagogy. Podcast.
Thank you, Michelle, and thank you, David. So now moving into our exciting new segment, Podcast Pedagogy. Loving the jingle. It's a work in progress. I might have to outsource that. But for now, Podcast Pedagogy. So we're going to be looking at what am I reading this week, and I've asked listeners to send in their influences and what they have been looking at based on guests on the podcast. So I'm delighted to say I've got both of those things in this week's show. So this week I have been reading What Works, Research and Evidence for Successful Teaching by Lee Elliott Major and Steve Higgins. So listeners may know Lee and Steve as the authors of the Sutton Trust and then EEF Teaching and Learning Toolkit. So moving into the book and in the introduction. So even as somebody working actively in the area of research and evidence, this introduction is a vital insight into both the development of the toolkit and how it should be used. There's also some insight into the limits of research, some unexpected findings, and some guided principles and effects which run through the book. So we've got the Banana-Rama principle. So depending on your age, listeners, you'll be able to complete the end of this song title. It ain't what you do, it's the way that you do it. All together now. Yes, indeed, that's what gets results. We also look at the Goldilocks principle, which is not too hot, not too cold, but just right. And the Matthew effect, which is that the poor get poorer and the rich get richer. And applying those principles and effects to education. So the authors intend this book to be used much as the toolkit is in terms of what is the approach or educational issue that you are trying to introduce in your school. Where has it worked previously? And they go into a little further into how it might work, some unexpected findings, and some teaching and leadership tips. They also have tips for listeners to take things a little bit further and some links there to look into. And as a bit of a research geek, as listeners will know, I love the technical notes section, and I have added this to my presentation, particularly the section on understanding the month's progress and how to convert them. So Steve and Lee are perfectly placed to debunk 10 teaching myths, and they do that with relish and panache in this book. I won't go into those here, as obviously listeners will want to read the book, and there are podcasts that are looking at things that you shouldn't do in education, so check those out, including, of course, Classroom 101, great podcast. The rest of the book tackles approaches, and it's a must-read for school leaders, and it's obviously remembering the importance of context. So, much as you need to stay till the end of a film to see the credits, the afterword is a podcast in itself, so I recommend this book heartily to all listeners. So the book again is called What Works by Lee Elliott Major and Steve Higgins. It's published by Bloomsbury and is available everywhere. So now we're going to go into a section from one of our listeners. So we have David Alderson talking about how Ollie Cav's work has influenced his practice. Over to you, David.
The episode with Oliver Caviglioli definitely had the biggest impact on me. My handwriting is not the best, and so I went into school the next day, started writing in capital letters on the board. Students immediately noticed the difference and were able to engage with what I was doing a lot better. Also, the way he talked about layout and presentation also has changed the way that I think about things, and this was before I got his book, but having read the book, obviously what he said made a lot more sense afterwards as well. So as a standout podcast, I would say that was the one for me.
Welcome to Naylor's Nattering, musings on evidence-based teaching and professional learning. Follow us on Twitter at PNA1977.
Okay, so Dame Alison Peacock, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for speaking to me so early in the morning. So we've had to do a nice early morning podcast this time. I'm normally an evening person, but this is great. So we've got a nice early morning one. Everybody should be fresh.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, could you tell listeners a little bit about your teaching career in which you first taught in secondary schools and then moved into primary schools?
Yes, so I started teaching in a secondary school in Harlow, and I was teaching years 7, 8 and 9, a very mixed timetable. I was there for a year, and then I moved from there to Leicestershire to a community college where, again, I was teaching mainly Key Stage 3, and we were teaching an extended timetable, trying to bridge the gap between primary and secondary. And then beyond that, moved to Hertfordshire, joined the advisory service, and then had some children. And then having children meant that I had the opportunity to go back to university part-time to study early years and special needs. So then I got a job in a primary school. So I've sort of taught across, you know, many age ranges in my career. Most latterly have been a primary head teacher.
Fantastic, fantastic. So if we're going right back again, I first personally became aware of your work that you were doing as head teacher in the early 2000s. So you took the Wroxham School on a real journey there. So if you could just tell us a little bit about that journey and the starting point and where you got to.
Yes, yeah, so I was deputy head at a school in Hertford and decided maybe now was the time to look for a headship. And I went to look around and I visited Wroxham, and the school had been in special measures for 3 years. Hadn't made any progress. HMI reports every term. And I looked around the school and decided, well, whatever I do, I can't make it any worse. So I'll give it a go and see if they'll appoint me as head teacher. And they did. And I remember the interview really clearly because they asked me to do a presentation about where would the school be under my leadership in 3 years' time, bearing in mind it's been in difficulties for 3 years. And I prepared this PowerPoint to say that in 3 years' time, the school would have a broad, balanced curriculum. There would be really high standards of achievement and attainment. We would work together as a team across the whole community, and the school would become a centre of excellence. And I look back now and think the governors who were interviewing me at the time probably thought, oh, bless. But the school did move. We came out of special measures in the October, as I joined in the January. We were outstanding within 3 years of my arriving in the January. In the second year, we were in the top 100 most improved schools. So the improvement was dramatic. But what was really exciting about that from my point of view was that it wasn't improvement born out of the slash and burn kind of approach to leadership. It was, you know, every teacher bar one stayed and became part of that school that was outstanding. And so that journey of professional learning, development, moving from being judged to be failing to being judged to being, you know, an outstanding school, you know, people came with me on that journey. And I think that's a really important point. And I wasn't doing it through telling people off either. Although, having said that, I think if you know me, you realise that probably I do set quite a high standard, so probably it's quite difficult to say no to me. But what I was trying to do was to you know, I said to the school community, this is, we're going to be known as a listening school. We're going to listen, we're going to understand from you. And building the confidence and the development and the skills of the teachers was about enabling them to see their classrooms through the eyes of the children, and together they were, you know, they became a learning community. And essentially that's what I'm now doing at the Chartered College, and I'm taking all of that research, all of that learning, all of that art of the possible, if you like, and saying what would happen if we applied this at scale to the whole teaching profession.
Yes. Absolutely, and more on that later. We'll definitely be talking about the work that you're doing with the Chartered College. I just wondered if I could ask you about Learning Without Limits. So at the time, Learning Without Limits was transformative for the school and, I would say, the profession more widely. So could you describe the ethos behind Learning Without Limits and the effect that it had?
Yeah, of course. So I was incredibly influenced throughout those early years of headship by the fact that I was also part of a Learning Without Limits research project. So the first project, the book was published in 2004, and I was one of the teachers who was researched for Learning Without Limits. So my classroom, when I was a deputy head, was one of the areas of, you know, there were 9 teachers who were researched, primary and secondary, and what the research team were looking at was classrooms where teachers refused to set limits on what they thought the children were capable of achieving. And this was right at the heart of the time when, you know, differentiation, ability groups, labelling children, you know, national curriculum levels, all of these things were absolutely at the forefront. So what we were doing was totally swimming against the tide by saying, no, actually, we want to be able to create an environment in our classrooms where children can surprise us. And that book was published in 2004. I took up the headship at Wroxham in 2003. And as I arrived at the school, I'd only been in the school a couple of weeks, when I received a phone call from the university saying, ha-ha, so, Alison, you're one of the Learning Without Limits teachers. This is great. Now you've come to a school which you're obviously going to lead without labelling, and you're obviously going to lead this school without any kind of ability grouping, and you're going to transform it, aren't you? And I remember thinking, oh, my goodness, I don't know what the heck I'm doing. I haven't got a clue how I'm going to make this work. I'm just intuitively trying to work with people and make things better. And the idea that the university would bid for some research funding and would then send researchers into the school to see beyond the rhetoric to what the reality was in classrooms. That was frankly quite terrifying. And I remember thinking, when I was listening, you know, don't say yes, don't say yes. And then I basically said, what a great idea, why don't you come? So they got the research funding, and then we started to research the growth of the school. And I was then an insider researcher and an outsider researcher, and that you know, I was keeping a leadership journal during that time. Researchers were coming in and working with teachers and groups of children and parents at the school. But the actual book that sort of tells the story of the school's movement from being judged by Ofsted as being a failing school to becoming an outstanding school, that book wasn't published until 2012. So although that sort of, we became outstanding in 2006, and we had another outstanding inspection in 2009 and another one in 2013. The actual book, Creating Learning Without Limits, wasn't published till 2012. So that was, you know, the research community moves at a different pace to the school community.
Yes.
But having said all of that, one of the lessons I learned from that, which is a really powerful lesson, was that I was more scared of the academics than I was of Ofsted. So I was more worried about doing the right thing, as those academics would see, the principled way of leading. I was more worried about making sure that I was adhering to those principles of Learning Without Limits, which are not labelling people, which is about taking everybody with you on the journey, not leaving anybody behind. It's about trust, and it's about building agency. And so my leadership at the school was I was very, very fortunate with hindsight to have that mentoring and that support from people like Mary Jane Drummond, who was actually, you know, every couple of weeks I would be going to the university and she'd be asking me really searching questions about my leadership. And, you know, now looking back, I see that that kind of coaching, mentoring, you know, that informed sort of scrutiny of what I was doing as a leader really helped me to be the best leader I could be. And if only head teachers now were more able to be influenced by those kinds of powerful, searching questions as opposed to sets of performance indicators that someone else sets, I think we'd be in a much better place.
Absolutely. Do you mind if I just pause us for a second? I'm not sure whether, I mean, I'm just listening to the sound quality. I can hear you okay and it's recording well. I'm just wondering, are you on speakerphone or are you actually on the handset?
No, I'm on the handset. I've got a mobile if you want to try it on a mobile.
No, we'll carry on. I mean, it's just a little bit crackly in the corner, but I mean, perhaps it's my end and I really do apologise.
Well, have a listen to the quality because I can hear something on the line now.
Right. I mean, it's okay. I just wondered maybe that was one of the things I could think of might be a little bit of an issue. But apart from, you know, it's fine. We'll just continue because obviously you're extremely busy. Moving into the next part. So this particular podcast that I'm doing started its life really focused on trying to share evidence and research-based practice. So as you may be aware, you know, I'm working in those areas through the research school at Blackpool. But it's something that you've been very much involved with. I know you touched on it there in your previous answer, but you've been working with research and evidence since the start of your career. So could you tell listeners about how you've been involved, how you've used it, and I suppose why you wanted to use it really, really early in your career?
Okay. So we should just answer that.
Yes, please, yeah.
Okay. So I've been involved in research. I've been interested in research and And there's a sort of innate restlessness about who I am as a person that constantly wants to explore things in more depth. So even as a newly qualified teacher, when I was working in Harlow, I was interested in this notion of transition between primary and secondary, and so I chose to teach a class in a local primary school, and once a week I taught them drama. You know, this was the beginning. There were no professional learning opportunities in that first year. There were no staff meetings beyond office kind of admin type meetings. There were no development meetings at all. But even in that first year, I chose to engage in this kind of self-study, if you like, of what would the transition be like. We understood more about the children coming in at the beginning of Key Stage 3. And then when I moved to Leicestershire, I was part of the Oracle study that was looking at again, how children learn. And then from there, I went to Hertfordshire, and I was working with the advisory service, again, building professional learning development, engaging with lots of the big ideas, because I would be involved in organising conferences, and people would come to those conferences and so on. And then I became involved with Professor Michael Fielding, who was interested in the work that was going on in my classroom related to pupil voice. And so together with Sarah Bragg, we engaged in a project there at the University of Sussex. You know, then going on to the work that I've done with Cambridge and beyond. So throughout the whole of my career, I've always been interested in the theory of what we're trying to do in schools and how that marries up with the practice. And quite often there's a big divide between, you know, you can read a research report, or you can read a book, and it doesn't automatically create the bridge for you between what you're doing in your classroom and the work that's been done theoretically. Then I started doing some work with the Cambridge Primary Review, so I worked with Professor Robin Alexander, and I was seconded 2 days a week to help colleagues in the primary phase really think about their curriculum design, think about you know, the level of challenge they were operating, giving to the children, the notion of dialogue and how the discipline of introducing dialogue in classrooms and so on. So I've been very fortunate that I've had all of those opportunities, but equally I have sought them out. And part of it has been the fact that I'm constantly wanting to understand more, because I think the job of being a teacher is so vastly complex. And, you know, you never, ever have well, I've never had a class that I've been taught in the same way exactly the next year with a different cohort, because you've got different children and different needs, and particularly in primary education, you know, those developmental needs can be very extreme, and it's constantly about how do you find a way through to enable the offer that you're creating in the classroom to resonate with the child's needs and to enable them to flourish. And that's always been something that's at the heart of what I believe as a teacher, you know, that you want to try and create the optimal conditions for every child to flourish within the space that you're teaching. So, I've been incredibly fortunate. And then, of course, the work that I was starting to do around assessment became quite important and influential at the time when national curriculum levels were removed, because in our school we weren't using national curriculum levels. And that was very radical. You know, back in the day, that was extremely radical, especially as, you know, it wasn't that we were outstanding so that Oxford didn't matter. I mean, we had, as I say, three inspections in that time where we were judged to be outstanding. What we could show, however, was that we were enabling, through essentially, now I sort of look at the EEF work on metacognition and think, well, this is exactly what we were doing, but we weren't teaching the children about metacognition. We weren't teaching the teachers about metacognition. What we were doing was enacting that process through pupil voice, through things like learning review meetings, where we asked the children to prepare a meeting so that they could talk about their challenges in their learning to their parents, to myself as head teacher, to their class teacher. And then we would look at the books together with the parents and the child, and together, as a group, we would define, you know, what are the next steps? What do you need to learn next? Where can we all help you? So it wasn't about saying to the child, you know, you're the expert, you know everything, we'll defer to you. It was about genuine co-agency, where the child's opinion of what they were finding difficult to learn was incorporated within the conversation about what do we do next, which replaced the traditional parents' evening. And then the way of working in the classroom was much more about, it wasn't about, is this work 4B, it was about what can I do to improve my writing. And so there were things that we were doing which were related to working in learning partners, and the learning partners changed every week. This was the children within the class. There were activities that were designed to help the children articulate what they were learning and what was working well, but also how they could improve their learning, and peer review came into that. But really crucially, the teachers at the same time were massively developing their practice. And so, you know, it was everybody together, working together to create the optimal conditions for the children. And it worked, you know, the standards were very high. So I think sometimes people worry that that kind of approach could feel quite fluffy. Actually, it was incredibly rigorous. So when Oxford did turn up, although we hadn't got tracking data and all the rest of it, what we had got was a very clear sense of, this is what the child knows, this is what they need to do next. The child knew what they were doing, because it wasn't someone else's target that they'd been given. It was their own generated self-review, you know, mediated by the teacher. And we could see, you know, we had an Excel sheet that said, this is where we think the children are going to be, you know, and this is where we think they are now. But what we didn't do was any kind of data drops. We didn't do any kind of holding teachers to account for how many points have you moved this child further forward. Our conversations about progress were about individual children. Where did we think the blocks were to their learning? What could we collectively as an organisation do to support each child to achieve? And for the children who were already excelling expectations, you know, what more could we do to continue them to be excited in their learning? So there was a rigour, but it was a different kind of rigour to the falling back on the, what does it say on the spreadsheet, that must be right then, because quite often those spreadsheets become a work of fiction, especially when they're linked to, you put them into something and then if they don't go green, you kind of think, oh, perhaps I ought to rethink that, and then change the number, and then suddenly they do go green, and that's brilliant, isn't it? But it doesn't mean anything. And then you can graph it, you can print it out and print the graph, and that doesn't mean anything either, but it suddenly starts to create a reality that feels quite authoritative, and it's actually not at all. But there's this kind of false sort of certainty that starts to emerge when you can track and graph and print things out and put them on the wall. Well, we didn't do that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I can think of the perfect, you know, the perfect curves or the perfect lines for the flight paths that we've seen at the time. In terms of that, the work that you're talking about there, that's coming from your book, which I think was from about 2016, was it? Assessment for Learning Without Limits. And that was also based on two research studies as well, wasn't it?
Yes. So again, so the Assessment for Learning Without Limits was an opportunity there to build on the work that we were doing as a teaching school, but also I'd started to do quite a lot of work nationally, and I asked colleagues to write to me if they felt they were doing something interesting in that space. You know, national curriculum levels had been removed, nobody knew what was coming next, there were all kinds of mad ideas appearing all over the place about what you could do, including one I seem to recall that was about dogs. This wasn't published in my book, this was to do with the fact that we developed the Beyond Level series of conferences. So Julie, Lily and myself started to provide conferences across the country that were completely free for people to come to. And the first one was at Sheffield Hallam. It was in May 2016. And there was somebody there who said that in her school, they had devised a system for assessment that was based on, you know, the Labrador group and the Poodle group and all this kind of thing. And I just remember thinking, I thought national curriculum levels were bad, but this is even worse. So we were trying to build some energy and hope across the system to say, assessment is something that you can do, teachers, because it's part of what you do all the time. It's just that as soon as you start to think assessment equals tracking, equals points of progress, people start to panic and think, well, I just can't do it. And so what we were trying to do, together with people like Sean Harford, who came to those conferences, Ofqual came, colleagues from secondary, primary, what we were trying to do was to help people to see that assessment is intrinsically linked to excellent teaching and curriculum design, and that when you can see that, you know, that you've taught something and you can see the child's response to that, essentially what you're doing is you're engaging in assessment when you're seeing how they're able to respond, whether they're talking or whether they're writing. You know, you can begin to understand what do they need to do next, what are their misconceptions. You know, that is real assessment, because that impacts on your teaching. And the kind of edifice of tracking, which had sort of come to sort of mean assessment in people's minds, didn't tell you anything, because that was only based on what you fed into the computer. So we did 13 of those conferences, 2016 into 2017, in universities across the country that were, everybody gave their time completely free. The universities gave their space completely free. We had some sponsorship from Frog. They provided sandwiches. But it was kind of a movement, and it was sort of its time. And then after 13 of those, we kind of felt people were beginning to feel a bit more confident, not just because of what we were doing, but I hope that we helped in that way. To enable people to understand a bit more about what it was that was possible now that national curriculum levels had gone, what was possible to do in terms of thinking about how you might assess. So people like Daisy Christodoulou came and presented, lead thinkers in the space, gave their time for nothing. Shirley Clark came, Ros Wilson, you know, people who had spent their careers thinking about these things or engaging in often quite expensive consultancy, just said, yeah, we'll come and help. Pike Orbit, another one. So it was good, I think.
It was. Absolutely it was, yeah. Absolutely it was. And it was very influential again at the time in terms of, you know, thinking that you could move away from levels, because, you know, we'd been so steeped in the kind of mantra of this is the way that we do things, to think outside of that, you know, it was quite a challenge at the time.
It was huge. And when I look back on it, you see, this is what I think is really important, you know, here, is that my professional courage was being bolstered by academics who I believe were highly respected in their field, saying, this is the right way to go. Look at the response you're getting from the children. Look at the way that your teachers are developing. Look at what's happening within the school. Look at the opportunities that you're providing. And then, as you know, Ofsted, who obviously everybody's terrified of Ofsted, regardless of new frameworks or not, we're all terrified of Ofsted. When they started to come and say, yeah, we endorse this, we're seeing something exceptional here, that then I felt gave me the freedom as a head teacher, rooted in practice, to begin to work beyond the school and say, there are other ways of doing things. There are other ways of imagining what this phase of education could be about. And so I think that's really, although it was kind of unconscious probably at the time, what I was doing when I did things like, you know, we bought the double-decker bus for the playground and we created a Celtic roundhouse in the grounds that was thatched and we had a big forest school area and a big music garden. And I think all of those things essentially were symptomatic of me trying to say, look, why not? There's nothing stopping you. This is all possible. No one's going to close you down because you've got an imagination. And in fact, if you're a leader without an imagination, what kind of leader are you? So, you know, people will say to me sometimes about, well, you know, we're not allowed to do this, are we? We have to do things by the book. And I always say to them, what book? Mm. You know, what's actually stopping you? I remember visiting a school that was on the coast. It was in the north of England. It was on the coast. It overlooked the seashore. And there was this beautiful picture window overlooking the sea. And I said to the head teacher, it must be wonderful. Are you still there?
I'm still here, yes. Yeah, I'm still there.
Yeah. It must be wonderful to be able to use the seashore for, you know, with your children. And she said, oh, we're not allowed. And I said, what do you mean you're not allowed? And she said, oh, no, local authority, risk assessments. And I said, oh, are they really strict then? So actually it turned out she was the one that was being really strict because there were risk assessment forms. She didn't want them filled in because she felt you never knew who was going to be on the beach, so therefore, let's not take the children. And you could literally see it out of the window.
Wow.
So, you know, that whole self-imposed, it can't be done, what's the point type approach. I was just trying, still am actually, just trying to say, look, there's another way that we can make education irresistible and joyful. But there's a rigor to it. It's not about or skipping off into the sunset. This is about how do you really challenge children's thinking and how do you provide the optimal kind of stimulus for that. There's no substitute for subject knowledge, though. So being able to know what you're talking about, get the best possible people to come in and work with your children and your teachers, bring the curriculum to life, all of these things, you know, I've been thinking about for a long time, and I'm really grateful and glad that the new Ofsted framework is helping people to think in this way. But just coming in on the train this morning, I was seeing tweets from people who were terrified about the concept of deep dives and the three I's and all this kind of stuff. You know, there's so many unintended consequences from anything that anybody does. I think Amanda Spielman is setting out, trying really hard to do something transformative, but the system has a kind of inertia within it that gets led by fear. So...
No, absolutely. I was just going to go off on a slight tangent there about the idea that of rigour and you mentioned about the three I's there, and I may well cut this part out, to be honest, but what I tend to find is that the Ofsted framework, for those that have read it and have digested it and have looked at it in detail and thought about it carefully, will understand that you don't need to go through your schemes of work just to rewrite three I's into them.
No, absolutely, but it's interesting, isn't it, how there's a kind of mythology that builds up really quickly. Because when I was at Roxham, when I was first there, the chief inspector was David Bell. And I remember booking onto a course in London to go and listen to David Bell himself. In fact, I sat right in the front row because I wanted to understand from him, you know, I'd obviously got the books and everything else that came with, but I wanted to understand from him what was the thinking behind, you know, his framework. So that I could understand what it was that they would be looking for when they came. And then that was kind of it. I knew then, straight from the horse's mouth, and then got on with whatever we were doing within school. But I'd always got that in my mind. You know, these are things that people are going to want to see when they come in. So sensibly, you just, you know, from my point of view, you work in that way. But you don't work to their agenda. You're just aware of it so that you make sure that you can answer questions when people come to visit that mean that's in their language of the time. It means that you can provide the evidence they're looking for.
Absolutely.
Instead of being worried about it, yeah.
No, definitely. Absolutely. Okay, speaking of, you know, making education, you know, rigorous, and also, this is a phrase that I've used, and it might be the incorrect phrase in some ways, but I'm a massive supporter of the work that you're doing with the Chartered College, and I think the college has already had a huge impact on what I'm saying is sort of re-professionalising teachers. So how have you sought to go about that, and what have been the sort of the key things in the vision and the mission for the Chartered College?
So the vision is that we raise the status of the teaching profession, and that in, you know, because we're raising the status through offering things like chartered status, we start to shift the culture within schools to one of high professionalism, which means that we enhance retention, we improve recruitment, and that ultimately the children's work, young people's work, standards improve, because everybody in the profession understands why they're there, what they're doing, how they can be valued, what their career pathway can be. Now, that is a huge kind of, that's on a document I was looking at yesterday, about a 10-year plan. But essentially, this notion of teacher as professional is so important. And this is a global issue. It's not just something that, you know, we're tussling with in England about numbers of people coming into the profession and the numbers of people that leave too quickly. And it's interesting that today there's a report that's been published by the IOE that's saying it's not actually numbers of hours. They haven't shifted over the last decade, the numbers of hours. Teachers work long hours. But there's something about working long hours because you choose to, because you're engaged with something, because you're interested in it, as opposed to working long hours because you feel that you're engaging in meaningless tasks that someone else is asking you to do. And all the things that you want to do are still there, building up, but you haven't got time to engage with them. So there's a really important mission that the Chartered College is on, is around how do we hear from teachers, enable them to share their best practice, work alongside academics. So the journal that we produce, Impact, it's just a copy that's come out this weekend. That's four times a year we're producing that journal. And we also produce a publication for new teachers called The Profession. And essentially what we're aiming to do with both of those publications is to, if you've looked at it, it's certainly not about dumbing down. It is about building that rigour and building that competency that means that you can constantly improve your teaching, and then share some of that practice. I mean, it's interesting. I saw that you just recently interviewed Doug Lamorth. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, what he is doing is really making it incredibly clear what are the steps that you might wish to take within your classroom to enable a safe, productive learning environment, you know, and of course he's doing much more than that, but actually articulating what is it that you do to enable that to happen is something that is kind of a first for teachers, because certainly when I started to teach, there was the kind of sense that you can either hack it or you can't. You know, I was an NQT, I was observed three times in that year, but if there'd been a riot going on in my class, then people would have noticed. And there's almost a sense of, yeah, you know, she can do it, oh no, perhaps he can't, without any sort of identifying of what are the skills involved, what are the strategies that you need. And of course, there are loads of skills and strategies that we have to be much better at sharing. So the early career framework that the college has been involved with, Kat Scutts has been on the team at the DfE working with the early career framework, is exactly about how do we surface these kind of core skills alongside utilising subject knowledge, alongside building that sense of what might be possible to achieve for every child, you know, never writing any child off. You start to build all those together and you start to create something that's really quite compelling. And it's not then a sort of dark art that you can either do it or you can't do it. It's something that you can learn. And then once teachers have been teaching for 3 years, we are offering the opportunity to study to become a chartered teacher. The first cohort that graduated in July, well, honestly, they were so proud because the work they're doing is directly related to their practice in classrooms. We're doing assessments based on their practice in classrooms. So there's an exam that you have to do. There's video evidence that you need to collect. You know, this is not a theoretical piece of work that you do that's sort of an adjunct to your day-to-day work. This is directly related to classroom practice. And because of that, you cannot wing it. You could not become a chartered teacher without actually being able to do something really quite brilliant in your classroom. And so we want to build that. We believe there are many, many, many teachers who are seeking recognition for what they do and will want to engage in that course of study. And then actually globally there's a huge interest because there's never been a portable status qualification badge of excellence across the world in terms of teaching. There is in areas like accountancy, you know, if you're a chartered accountant wherever you are in the world, people recognise that status. And that's another ambition for the college, that we help people to gain that recognition. It's not going to be for everybody. It's not going to be that every teacher is going to want to engage in 15-month study to achieve that recognition, but there will be a significant group of people, I think, who will. And they themselves then start to move the practice on within their sphere because they have become enlightened. They've looked at the literature. They've started to apply the literature to their practice. They're then very, very keen advocates on behalf of engaging in evidence.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the early careers framework, I mean, that's something that I've talked about previously on the podcast and something that I've blogged about as well in terms of the importance of that document to be in the hands of teachers. And, you know, just to go off on a sidetrack about this, but you know, I've been an SLT member, assistant head teacher, for 10 years now, and the number of positions that have been involved in senior leadership teams around things like data or, I mean, there's other important roles, but there would never seem to be the emphasis on the development of staff. That always seemed to be a tacked on responsibility. So, you know, professional mentor or whatever it was called in particular schools was an extra additional responsibility alongside data or alongside behaviour or alongside some part of pastoral. And actually the early careers framework, both in, you know, what it's going to do for the new teachers, but it's also developing and you know, prioritising the role of the mentor in sharing the, you know, the best practice with new teachers.
And what's interesting there, of course, is that if we're not careful, we start to build a level of expertise and knowledge in our newest teachers that may not always be met with similar experience within the school. So one of the things that we're looking at the moment is developing a chartered leadership status, which is not leadership in terms of management, but leadership of learning. Because you could have been a teacher 10, 15, 20 years and never revisited anything to do with the theory of learning. You might not have come across any of the new thinking about cognitive science. You might not understand any of that. And you could have a trainee and you could have people in your school who are aware of these things, who are wanting to implement them. And you might feel somehow, well, you either might block it or not notice it or not make it optimal, or in fact feel maybe quite threatened by the fact that you don't know so much about this as perhaps some of the new teachers do. So we're really keen that we build that expertise at every level. So we've got the, you know, the early career framework which we're supporting. We've got the chartered teachers, and then we want to develop this chartered leadership status. And essentially, you know, with those new heads of school roles that are developing across academies, your job if you're a head of school is no longer about managing the budget. It's no longer about HR. It's about what it should always have been, really, except that the job's too vast. But you know, as head of school, your job is leading learning. Mm. And that then is about how do you build the expertise of your teachers and how do you enable your teachers to behave in an optimal manner to enhance the learning of the children and young people. Well, it's not by telling them, well, I'm going to come and do another book scrutiny. That's not going to make the difference. What's going to make the difference is working as a community in the way that we did at Wroxham. You know, we described our work as a collective endeavour because there you're sharing your expertise and your wisdom, but you're also referring to the evidence, to the research. You're looking out beyond your multi-academy trust, beyond your school, and saying, what have other people done in this situation? What evidence is there? What might we do differently that could make the difference? How might we remove these barriers to learning for some of our children? And that's, you know, that's something that we've all been seeking to do since, you know, since forever. So, you know, genuinely, I know I'm an over-optimistic person, but I genuinely think starting to enable colleagues to think in this way and to share their ideas could be genuinely transformative.
Absolutely.
It moves away from that punitive sense of you tell me what you're going to do and then come back and show me that you've done it, to what can we collectively do to make the difference?
And what you've worked that's gone on with the early careers framework in terms of teacher standards and something that as a long-standing professional mentor, as I've just explained there, you know, the subjective use of teacher standards, because they were so, you know, open to interpretation, that now the early careers framework has given very clear you know, best practice that you can attach to each of those teacher standards. And like you said, it's very informative for the new teacher, but also for the mentors and for the senior leadership team as well.
Yeah, exactly. Sort it all out.
Well, I think that you are. Yes. Just in terms of the Impact magazine, and you said, I don't know if I've seen it. Of course, I've seen it, and I've read every single edition that we've had so far. And not only that, but I've also interviewed some people that you've had who've written in here. So Professor Michael Young was a recent guest on the podcast, and he's written for Impact magazine as well. So it's a brilliant read, and I see it everywhere on Twitter. Everybody's reading it, and now, without plastic, which I love.
Yes, indeed. I mean, you also saw probably the photograph of the dog that was very... that had eaten one of the front covers of one of the Impact. We've just sent a new copy because we felt, you know, if we can reduce plastic, fantastic. If some copies arrive damaged, you know, we'll just replace them. But far better that than sending out, you know, tens of thousands of copies. That, although the previous wrapping was compostable, not everybody is as conscientious as they might be. So we're trying our best. Yeah, we're trying our best in that space.
Absolutely. So in terms of those articles, how do you go about selecting which articles are published?
So we have three members of staff who work full-time on our journal, which means that actually the journal makes a loss for the organisation, although it's our flagship product. And this is because we have people who obviously review and scrutinise the input, but they flat plan, they commission work to balance off other work. So we're constantly trying to make sure that whatever the theme is for the journal, that we have got contributions from teachers or academics across every phase, that where there are, and there often are in education, you know, there are sort of different ways of looking. We're wanting to respect a plurality of voices around any particular issue, but we're very... very kind of mindful that we don't want to land in one place as opposed to another. We're trying to be as balanced as we possibly can. And so that takes a lot of work. And it means that, you know, hopefully when the journal arrives, everybody who has contributed, and there are further contributions online beyond just the ones in the printed journal, but everybody who's contributed knows that their contribution has been scrutinised, it's been peer-reviewed, you know, no one's going to be called out with a kind of, hang on a minute, didn't you forgotten to mention this study that was published, you know, that's more informative than that one, you know, none of that is likely to happen, she says, crossing fingers now. But, you know, because we've got a research team here who are working on that to really make sure that we are offering a very balanced, informative view. It's not something that's just thrown together. But as the organisation grows, as the college grows, as we grow more membership, you know, the content of the journal becomes more and more influential. And so people who are published, you know, when they're published in one of those issues that goes into every school in the country, so, for example, the EdTech edition that was published in January, every school in the country received that. That's a pretty big thing if you're a teacher writing something, you know, 25,000 schools. Absolutely. So we want to make sure that people feel very proud, but also that we are beginning to educate the profession. And I don't mean that in a patronising way. People are very pleased. They're very supportive of what we're doing because it's accessible, but it's not dumbed down. And there are always further references. And then, of course, if you're a member of the college, you have the access to the EBSCO research database, which means that should you wish to spend hours and hours and hours going through articles related to whatever it is that you're interested in, you can. And why is it that we've never had this before for teachers? You know, the only way that teachers have been able to, in the past, have been able to access that research database is if they were paying the fees to be associated with the university for further professional study. So we're trying to make evidence available for everybody, and working closely with the EEF as well to really help schools understand what the key messages are, I think.
Yes, absolutely, and that's something that we're very much involved with as well, and the reason for the podcast in the first place. Just last couple of questions, if you don't mind. So I can't believe that anybody who is listening, looking at my timeline and the number of people that, you know, proudly have FCCT on their Twitter headlines, but for anyone who's not a member of the Chartered College, how can they go about getting involved?
So the website is chartered.college. It's £3.75 a month to join as a member if you're an experienced teacher. It's only £1.88 for an NQT, and it's free for students. So we try to make it as, you know, as cheap as we possibly can. People say to us, oh, it's too expensive. We think, oh, well, I'm sorry. World doesn't work in a way where things are just done for nothing. I know we did the Beyond Levels conferences for nothing, but, you know, generally speaking, we have to be paid in order to make the organisation thrive, and we will be independent of government from April next year. So we will be relying on membership, and we'll be relying on income generated through things like the Chartered Teacher Programme and so on. But the more that we develop as an organisation, the more we want to give back. So one of the things that we have in our 10-year plan is that if we build sufficient subscriptions, we will want to take part of that subscription and put it back to the region where members are. So if you're a teacher in Bradford and you are a member of the Chartered College, that you would know that part of your subscription was going back to a fund in Bradford that was going to be managed by local teachers, that was for sabbaticals or for contribution towards PhD study or whatever it may be. You know, we genuinely want to be able to enable the profession to have a sense of agency and independence. It is about building expertise, and we think that's the best way to do it. We're way off that at the moment, but having said that, September's a lovely month. People come back to school very keen, and we're getting a huge number of people interested in joining us. So who knows? If we can achieve that 10-year plan, we would be the first organisation to do that, to provide a fund with no strings for teachers, managed by teachers.
Well,
how brilliant is that?
Absolutely. And well, and with your record that you mentioned at the beginning and the team that you've got behind you, you know, we're like the governors at the first school sitting there going, you know, good luck. Well, you've absolutely got there first time, and I have no doubt whatsoever that the Chartered College will achieve everything in the 10-year plan without a shadow of a doubt.
Great. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate your time this morning. Thank you for everything that you're doing for the profession with the Chartered College. And you know, I wish you all the best. Things for it go from strength to strength. And I enjoy reading Impact magazine. And one day, who knows, you know, I might even try and pen something for the Chartered College, hopefully.
Well, absolutely you should. Absolutely. We'll look forward to seeing that. Thank you.
Dame Alison Peacock, thank you so much for your time this morning. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much. Bye.
Bye. Absolute privilege there to interview Dame Alison Peacock. And once again, massive thank you to her for giving up her time to speak to us on the podcast. So before we do the shameless plug section, I'd like to do a thank you section, and I'd like to thank Sarah Bedwell and everybody at Lead Learn Lancs last weekend over in Burnley. It was fantastic for me to go back to the site of the school where I started teaching way back in the turn of the millennium. It was fantastic to be in there. So thank you to Sarah and everybody else for organising that event. And thank you for those that came along to listen to me talk about the work of Blackpool Research School and the Teacher Development Trust. If you are fairly local or maybe even a little bit further afield and you want to go to that conference, I'm sure that Sarah, we're running that into 2020. So get your name down for tickets as early as you can, as I know it sold out very, very quickly last time. Usual shameless plug section now, so we're going to shameless plugs again for our wonderful research head Blackpool, which is topped the 650 mark now with tickets, so we are about to press the pause on that, definitely this time, and it makes us officially, according to a tweet that I saw from Tom Bennett last week, the second highest attending research head conference, which is just amazing, and credit to everybody that comes along, gives up their time and presents. We've got lots and lots of new people presenting this year. We've got lots and lots of people presenting from all over the country, but also from Blackpool. And we've got more strands of more different areas of teaching than ever before. So come along and check that out. Research Head Birmingham, I'll be speaking at in March as well. And Claire Stoneman is going to be coming on the podcast to talk about all things leadership. So if you've listened to Claire talk before at Research Head conferences, or maybe you've listened to the TES podcast that she did there, she's absolutely brilliant. So I'm really, really looking forward to recording that one over half term, and that should be coming out fairly soon afterwards. Okay, into the podcast pedagogy plug section, easy for me to say. if the jingle hasn't put you off enough, we're going to try that again next week. So I am going to be reading in the next week or so The Educated Guess, How to Challenge Invisible Biases and Make Better Education Choices. And that's written by Warwick Sharp. So I've got in touch with Warwick and he has said that he will come on the podcast to talk about that in the next few weeks. Okay, so into the next couple of weeks' shows, we like to do a bumper half-term and holiday special. So I'm looking to release two, possibly even three podcasts during the half-term period, and it will be definitely the long-awaited Carpool for School podcast will be coming out over half-term. So it just remains for me to say once again, thank you very much for listening to Nailers Natter, and hopefully you'll be joining us again soon. If it's your half-term next week, enjoy the rest. Enjoy the relaxation. If you get time for a podcast, there's lots of good ones available. And if you'd like to choose this one, great. So again, thank you for listening to Nailers Natter and see you next time.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.